of the state of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Good morning. Please be seated. Well, our first case for this morning, 03-1331, Paul J. Everson versus Richard J. Lorenz. Our first counsel for Richard J. Lorenz and Lorenz Land Development is Mark S. and is it DeRosha? Counsel?
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Mark DeRosha and I have the privilege here today to represent Mr. Richard Lorenz and Lorenz Land Development. Mr. Lorenz is present here this morning and seated behind me. I do believe this is a privilege for me to have the opportunity to address this court, and on behalf of Mr. Lorenz, I know he appreciates the fact that you're considering these issues that are of great importance to him. We're here obviously this morning because we disagree with the assessment that the insurance company Pekin made of its obligations in this case, and we disagree with the result in the trial court. We do agree with the analysis of the facts and the issues that was presented to the court in the certification from the Court of Appeals, and I do not believe any lengthy recitation of the facts or the issues is necessary. In short, we believe that the allegations of the plaintiff's complaint, the Everson's complaint, particularly those dealing with negligent misrepresentation, sufficiently coincide with the language of the Pekin policy as to have triggered Pekin's duty to defend Lorenz and Lorenz Land Development on the merits of this case.
Well, why is this an occurrence?
It's an occurrence because as it's defined in the policy, it's an accident. And Pekin's urging this court to find that a negligent misrepresentation can never be an occurrence. And I'm not standing up here to argue the opposite. I'm not going to ask this court to say that a negligent misrepresentation is always an occurrence. What we're asking this court to do, and what we think is a logical extension of your decision in Smith versus Katz, is to say that the misrepresentation alleged in this case was an occurrence.
And you base that, I assume, on the fact that there was a scrivener's error, or there was an error in the contractual. Is that what you base it on?
I'm not saying that a negligent misrepresentation made in the traditional sense could not be an occurrence, could not be an accident, but I'm saying that in this case, that error, which is clear from the pleadings, makes it clear that this is an accident in the traditional sense, that it was.
How could your claim
21 rather than 31 in the report? Is that what you mean?
That's what I mean. It's in the record that Mr. Lorenz prepared the condition report, that he typed it. Mm-hmm. He hit a 2 instead of a 3, which to compare it to your traditional accident situation is like I don't see any difference between that and hitting the gas instead of the brakes.
But the damage here, that we talk damage, basically you're talking about something that was in a floodplain. And could that ever, tell me how that could come under that could come under this policy. Now, let me just, it's my assumption that, there are a lot of homes here that the Evensons could have at least built on this property. It wasn't the issue here that the landscaping that they could get some use out of this, but they couldn't get the use that they wanted out of the. Is that an incorrect or correct statement of what?
As it turned out, the fashion of the way it worked, at the time there were not a lot of homes yet in the subdivision. Everson's purchased the home. They commenced construction of the home, as you know from the record.
They could have built the home, right? I mean, my assumption was they could have built the home. It was really the I don't want to say the amenities or the landscaping, whatever they were going to do.
Initially, there was some question whether the foundation was or was not in the floodplain, and they stopped construction. Turned out it was close but was not in.
Right.
They still decided that they did not want a complete construction of the home because they did not believe that they could have the kind of home that they wanted to have, that they could not use that home the way they anticipated.
All right. Now, your client, who is the seller of that property, tell me how you feel you fall under when we talk about the damage or the occurrence. How does that become that? That's what I want to put into perspective what we're talking about.
Well, there's, I guess under Smith versus Katz, we're supposed to talk about cause and we're supposed to talk about damage. I gather from your question you want me to talk about damage, so that's where I'll go. It's in the record and unrefuted by Pekin, at least in the record, that Pekin had some pre-suit knowledge about specifically what the type of damage that Eversons were looking to recoup. There's a list that was provided by their attorney, that was provided by me to Pekin before the suit was filed, presumably putting them on notice that they had fair notice of the specific kinds of damages that Eversons were looking to recover for things like building plans and windows and foundation and things that they believed in their own minds that they were not going to be able to use because they were not going to complete this home.
Did it include the purchase price of the lot?
That list that was provided to Pekin pre-suit did include the purchase price. And as it turns out, that was not included among the damages that they sought because the lot sold prior to the suit being filed. But that original list provided by Pekin, in all fairness, did include that figure.
I assume that you're coming in under means physical injury, too, and there is no physical injury. There's no destruction of tangible property. So you have to be coming in under loss of its use.
That's absolutely where we're coming in under. Loss of use of tangible property, not physically injured or destroyed. And the property that I'm alleging that we're talking about is the property that Eversons purchased, windows, materials for the home, that they are claiming they were not able to use because they were not going to complete the home.
These are like consequential damages if we look at it as a breach of contract, right?
If we were to look at it as a breach of contract, I would classify them as consequential damages. I'm not hanging my hat on the breach of contract claim. I think they can be considered as, just as easily be considered as tort damages.
You know, I was interested in the offer to purchase. It says that there was title insurance that was provided by your client. Was this an exception? Was the floodplain listed as an exception in the title policy?
I'm well versed on that issue because I wrote the title insurance policy.
Oh, well, good.
which accepted and put the purchaser on notice that this particular lot was in the floodplain. That the limited discovery we had, though, at least to date, he's denying having that information.
I see. Well, you may ultimately win that lawsuit. Your issue before us is whether your client pays attorney fees for winning the lawsuit or the insurance company pays.
Absolutely. And the lawsuits were not supposed to get to the merits, so that's absolutely my position.
You take the complaint is not having dismissed for failing to state a cause of action. So it's an ongoing complaint. Now, one of the problems I've always had in several of these insurance cases is A sues B, and A drafts the complaint to win against B. And A may or may not think of the insurance company, may not know there's an insurance company. And so then between B, the defendant, and C, the insurance company, comes in and says, oh, the complaint isn't good enough for us. Well, what can you do? You can't amend that complaint. You're stuck with a complaint, and that has nothing to do with your insurance contract policy. And yet we got law in the cases that say, you look at the four corners of the complaint. I don't know that it makes much sense to me when I look at it in this sense of the case. But it might, counsel, so you haven't got me yet. So what do you think the court should do? Now, what you're doing is you're saying, whoa, it's in the complaint, that is, that there's damage. And the details of the damage were provided to your insurance policy, your insurance insurance company. But what kind of rule of law do you want us to take out from this?
As I said, what I think you need to do is do what you left the door open on in Smith versus Katz. You had the foresight to say, we're not going to say in this case that negligent misrepresentations cannot be occurrences. We can't decide that on the facts before us. This case allows you to, what it shows is that indeed was foresight, because here we have a case where a negligent misrepresentation is an occurrence, is an accident, and how you're going to craft the rule, I'm not going to presume to be able to sit up there and say, but I think what you need to do is continue recognizing that there needs to be some flexibility and not adopt the insurance company's position that a negligent misrepresentation can never be an occurrence.
I thought maybe you were going to say that forget accident, because it's specifically defined and it includes continuous or repeated exposure to a harmful condition. And that's what you essentially might have here if it's in the floodplain. And maybe you didn't have to do any representation or lack thereof and give a warranty deed. Title insurance is silent. But I don't intend to have this be an insurance company, title insurance company play. And then you say, hey, this fire has been damaged because there's a continuous or repeated exposure.
I'm not going to disagree with that analysis. I guess I always sort of just disregarded that language that followed accident, and I don't know if that aspect's been looked at in this case. I think we've been looking at dictionary definitions for what accident means, but I would agree that it fits. You make that misrepresentation, and it has continuous effects.
Was there any affirmative representation that Lot 31 was outside the floodplain other than this 21 for 31 in that condition report?
Depends who you believe. The plaintiff says that there were verbal, and Mr. Lorenz says that he clearly told Mr. Everson that the lot, part of the lot, was in the floodplain. In fact, that he went out there and took a look at it, and he showed him where it was. Mr. Everson denies. And that's they're verbal. Nothing else written that I'm aware of.
So there was no affirmative statement it was outside. You're saying there was an affirmative statement that the floodplain was on the lot. And he's saying, you simply never told me that. So his only affirmative statement is from that condition of the property thing that he typed up where he put 21 instead of 31, right?
I would say that's what the plaintiff's hanging their hat on in this case. Is that
so? I understood perhaps or misunderstood your answer then. I understood your earlier response to be that there was an issue of fact. The plaintiff says there were other misrepresentations made, verbal, besides the 2131, that it was outside the floodplain. But Everson said he went out and showed them even where the floodplain went. And so I understood in response to Justice Prosser, your response to essentially be, that's an issue of fact. The plaintiff and defendant disagree as to whether or not there were misrepresentations about the floodplain outside the 2131. Your response to Justice Rogensack seems to be the only thing the plaintiff is hanging the hat on is 2131. So which is it?
Okay. I understand. There, I think otherwise you've got your word against mine, and what I meant was I think that's primarily what the plaintiff is relying on in order to meet their burden of proof.
I still don't understand your answer, so you're going to have to help me. Okay. That's primarily what they're relying on. What is the that? And even if it's primarily, it doesn't mean exclusively. Okay. So let me get this focused. Is the plaintiff asserting that there are other misrepresentations?
Yes.
Outside of the 2131 regarding the floodplain?
Verbal, yes.
Yeah, verbal misrepresentations.
Yes.
Okay. Are the affirmative representations, he told me it was outside the floodplain, or are they, he never told me it was outside the floodplain? I mean, one's an omission and one's an affirmative representation. That's what we're both trying to get to here.
I didn't examine the deposition transcripts at length because I didn't know we were going to get into the facts.
Sure.
But my recollection and Mr. Lorenz's recollection is that never, that he never, he just never told them that.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Lorenz says, well, we were at the site and I showed him.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so you said that there were verbal misrepresentations. I'm a little hard-pressed to understand how there are verbal, that is, speaking misrepresentations, if on the other hand, you're saying nothing was said, it was by omission. So I just need to know. Was there a verbal, that is, talking, or was there an omission, that is, no talking?
I think that the law in this state is that you have to speak if you have a duty to speak, and I think that's what
I just want to know what the facts are.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, the allegation on page 105 is that the representations made by Lorenz regarding the location of the 100-year floodplain and 31 were made as a representation of fact. Such representation of fact was untrue, and that they made it negligently. And the plaintiffs believed it was true and relied thereon to their damage. And number five says, pursuant to the terms of the offer and his owner, they purported to disclose in writing to the plaintiffs what portion of the development lay within the 100-year floodplain. Lorenz disclosed to the plaintiff that no portion lay within the 100-year plain, and then they attach Exhibit B, and Exhibit B is the, if I remember, but we can look at it so we don't have to rely on me. Exhibit B is... hard to tell what Exhibit B is at the moment.
It's the conditions.
Yeah, are the conditions. And that's where 21 and 31 appear. Is that it? Or the yes, no, right?
It's yes on the circle, the answer, and then the explanatory page that's incorporated into the condition report is where we have the typo.
That's 115, page 115 of the appendix, right?
Correct.
Okay. So the claim that's made here basically is that by misrepresentation, Evenson was caused to enter to purchase the lot that's at issue here, right?
That's right.
That's what we're looking at. Now, how does the economic loss doctrine bear on that question, if at all, in your opinion?
I don't think it does.
Why not?
Because there's a couple of different answers to that. The answer that the Court of Appeals gave in the Jarris case is, at this stage where we're talking about duty to defend, we don't talk about economic loss doctrine. That's a merits issue. And
defense to the initial lawsuit.
It's a defense. If the insurance company thinks that the economic loss doctrine bars this claim, then they should file that motion on behalf of their insured rather than use it as a basis not to defend their insured. That's what the Court of Appeals said in Jarvis, and I agree with that. My other answer to that is...
That would make it comparable to a defense of contributory negligence.
Oh, correct.
Or something, even a straight negligence case.
Or whether or not reliance on the representation is reasonable. All those kind of issues that eventually will be gotten to if there's a trial in this case. My other answer is I don't... If I need to get to that, is I don't think this Court's taken the economic loss doctrine that far yet. The latest statement was the Van Leer case, which was limited to commercial transactions. And I guess while I have a chance, I don't think the Court should take it that far. So I'll leave that at that.
But you see it as an affirmative defense or something that should be raised in summary judgment, not raised when you're trying to get defense for your client.
I think it's a merits issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr.
Desrochers.
Thank you. I think your position is that the misrepresentations in this case caused the purchase of the property. But the misrepresentation does not cause the property to be in a flood plain. How does the misrepresentation cause property damage?
You know, I understand the Smith versus Katz tells us we're supposed to do that analysis. And my answer to this question is there are multiple answers to this one, too. I think one thing I'd ask the Court to consider is if we're starting to talk about cause, isn't that a merits issue? That's where I would start. And that argument wasn't made up by me. And the Sheets case that I've cited to the Court, that's what they said. They said the cause issue should be similar to like we were talking about with the economic loss doctrine issue. It's a merits question. And if cause is tenuous, then the insurer should file a motion to dismiss because they can't establish cause. The other thing I'm having trouble with is I don't have a hard time with a plaintiff who alleges negligent misrepresentation establishing cause simply by saying, I relied on this statement and I was damaged. And if I would have been provided other information, I would have done something differently and I wouldn't have been damaged. And I think those elements have been fled here.
Doesn't that go to the heart of Mr. Weiss's argument that you have to allege as part of the complaint property damage, not just damage?
And I think that what you need to look at is duty to defend stages is does, you have to read the whole complaint, first of all, and does this complaint allege something, is it more specific than damage? And it certainly is. There's the paragraph that the Court of Appeals pointed out where Eversons are talking about how due to the misrepresentations, it was impossible for us to build the home where we wanted to build it. And you've got to give some meaning to that language. And the meaning I give to that language, particularly in the context of I know what the Eversons specifically are looking for, I don't know how to categorize that other than as loss of use of tangible property. And at a minimum, I think it put the insurance company on notice that, hey, what they're looking for here is something beyond your traditional damages that you look for in a misrepresentation claim. Everson's not saying, I want the benefit of my bargain. He's not saying, I paid $30,000 for this lot. It's in a floodplain. It's only worth $15,000. Pay me the difference. He's asking for something different than that. And I think that the insurance company's on notice of that. And I mention notice because this Court in Smith versus Katz placed emphasis on that.
Well, we seem to have a conflict between the general rule that this is notice pleading and you don't have to say too much, And the rule that where all of a sudden you got a third-party insurance company in the case, that you take pleadings over which you have no control and demand that they fit a contract in which maybe the plaintiff should be interested, but apparently was not, and may not have even known about this insurance. I'm not quite sure how we can fit those two doctrines. And how do you suggest we fit them?
I understand what you're suggesting or what where the court could go with that, and I agree. I don't know that it makes a lot of sense that this rule that we have. I'm just in the position that that's what the rule is, and I have to follow it at this point. I don't know that I know what to suggest.
Now, on causation, I gather that the concept is there was a misrepresentation. As a result of it, the lot was bought. As a result of it, construction was begun, relying on the misrepresentation so that you're not barred as to where you can put the house on the property. Then it is discovered that there is a misrepresentation and that the house cannot, at least if you accept this as true, cannot be built as planned and therefore is not of value to this buyer. And so you've got at least several steps in this causation.
I don't agree there are several steps. I don't think we have the intervening causes that this court was concerned about in Smith versus Katz. And I also, you know, in Smith versus Katz, they were talking about intervening acts of others. We certainly don't have any intervening acts of others here. And I think, I guess I'm going to stick by my explanation of cause that I gave earlier. I relied. I was damaged. If I'd have known otherwise, I'd have done something different and I wouldn't have been damaged. I don't think alleging causation in a negligent misrepresentation case is all that difficult.
Okay, counsel, thank you. Your time is up. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Weiss, representing Pekin Insurance Company.
Thank you.
Justice, counsel, may it please the court. My name is Monty Weiss, Weiss Law Office. I represent Pekin Insurance Company in this case. One of the things that I heard a lot of questions and a lot of comments about in Mr. DeRoche's argument and questions from the court was comments made during depositions, other parts of discovery. We're here for a duty to defend analysis in which we do look at the language of the complaint. What does the complaint say? We have a time-honored standard rule in this state of how we look at duties to defend, and that is we compare the allegations of the complaint to the policy, and we see whether or not there is any possibility that if the allegations were true, proven true, then there'd be a duty to indemnify.
But, Counselor, can't we look at, and be consistent with that rule, can't we look at a deposition that isn't inconsistent with anything in the complaint? So you're not really changing what was pled by the deposition. You're just further explaining it. Is there something wrong with our doing that?
This court could do whatever it wants to do. As I said in my brief, the law in this state has been very, very clear that we don't do that. We look at the four corners of the complaint. We match the language up with the policy, and then we make our analysis at that point. We don't look to depositions, discovery, things like that, in order to determine if there's a duty to defend based on the four corners of the complaint.
Counsel, I agree with that because there's just so many cases cited for that proposition. In the context of that, you look to the four corners of the complaint. Also, there are so many cases cited for the proposition that in looking to the four corners of the complaint, however, the allegations of the complaint are to be liberally construed. Is that your understanding
Yes.
of how those two mesh? They are liberally construed when you're looking at, and you know, you and I both can cite numerous cases when you're looking at an insurance contract with regard to insurance coverage. You look to the four corners of the complaint, but never, and in looking at that, we liberally construe.
I think the language is broadly construed, but I think the point is still the same that you're making. I agree.
Depending on the case, some say,
yes.
Yeah, some say liberally.
Sure. With that in mind, in this particular case, if we look at the complaint that the Eversons filed, the language that they used is no different than what we saw in the Benjamin case and really no different than what we saw in the Smith case. What they've alleged in each of the causes of action and looking at it specifically as it relates to negligent misrepresentation and misrepresentation strict responsibility is that negligent in paragraph 12, they relied thereon to their damage. And strict responsibility relied upon them to the plaintiff's damage.
Yeah, but look at 7, which is preparatory to all of them. And in 8 is incorporated. 7 says it rendered the property unbuildable for the plaintiffs. So that was their damages.
If you look at the, we can pick out words, individual ones, and try and emphasize them over others, but I think when you look at paragraph 7 in its entirety, and even as conceded in an oral argument here by Mr. DeRocher, is it wasn't that the property was unusable for them. It was that we couldn't build the house we wanted in the location that we wanted to. That doesn't constitute a loss of use.
We're talking about backyard landscaping?
Right. And we cited it. That's more of the duty to indemnify. But if you look at even the language and taking the complaint as a whole, reading the language, not giving overemphasis to either one phrase or the other, if you look at the thrust of paragraph 7, it says basically we couldn't build the house where we wanted to build it. It's not a loss of use. That may not be I couldn't. It's not that I can't use the property at all. It's worthless to me. It is, I can't build the precise house that I want in the precise location. And I think there's some case law, Trios we cited, that really isn't enough to constitute a loss of use under an insurance policy.
Isn't that outside the complaint, though, what you just said?
It is what outside the complaint? I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
The thing about building not quite where we wanted to.
No, it's right in the complaint, paragraph 7. If you look at, I'm going to just go down line 3, it says, making the construction of the home they wish to construct on the property impossible in the location in which the plaintiffs wish to build based upon the pre-suit representations. So it's right there in the complaint.
Well, that may not, is that allegation true?
Again, the answer to the question is I don't believe that's true because ultimately they admitted in their deposition testimony they were able to build the house where they wanted to. They just couldn't do the aesthetic landscaping that they wanted to do, or at least not all of it. They wanted to put some berm in there.
But for purposes of this case, don't we have to assume that that language is true?
Sure, and taking a look at the facts, if we assume the facts to be true here, it just says that we couldn't build the house in the location where we wanted it to build. And that, like I indicated before, is not really loss of use, looking at Wisconsin case law on it. One of the other points that I wanted
to say as a matter of law, that does not state a claim that is covered with the insurance company or the contract.
I'm sorry, could you just
You would
me?
Say that inability to build the house the way they wanted to, whether it's landscape or otherwise, as a matter of law, taking that as true, as a matter of law, does not constitute loss of use under the insurance contract. Therefore, you don't have to defend. Is that your position?
That is our position on loss of use, yes.
And you're relying on the case?
Trio's case, and also taking a look at what the Court of Appeals discussed in Wisconsin Label.
Just to follow up on that, counsel, then, where in the complaint is it that they didn't want to they weren't able to build where they wanted to build?
If you look at paragraph 7, it starts on the back half of the second line. It says, well, just read the, I'll read this thing. Subsequently, the plaintiffs discovered that a substantial portion of Lot 31 lay in the 100-year floodplain, making the construction of the home which they wish to construct on the property impossible in the location in which the plaintiffs wish to build.
Based upon the pre-sale representations of Lorenz rendering the property unbuildable for the plaintiff, unbuildable for the plaintiff, to me that sounds a little bit different than I can use the property yet, but I just can't build it right where I want to build it. It sounds to me that the allegation in 7 says rendering, quote, rendering the property unbuildable for the plaintiffs. Help me with that, because that's, I hear a difference between what you are saying and what's in paragraph 7. So,
And looking at it, paragraph 7, and as I indicated before, I think looking at paragraph 7, you look at the whole paragraph. And looking at it, says we can't build the house that we want to build, and that's rendering our property unbuildable. That's just a use of a property. It my position is, on loss of use anyway, is that the property has to be, you can't use the property at all. Building a single-family house, which is what was represented in paragraph 4 of the complaint, that's what their intended purpose was, to use the lot. It doesn't mean the lot is useless. It doesn't mean that I can't do anything with it. It is not a loss of use. It's not the loss of use of a property. It's a particular type of use that I can't do. I can't build a house there, perhaps. It doesn't mean that the property is completely useless. For example, building it on a landfill or having some pollution on it that would preclude any use of it at all. And I think when you look at the Wisconsin label case, the Court of Appeals decision when they talked about it, Wisconsin law does require the complete uselessness of the property in order to constitute a loss of use under the policy.
In looking at paragraph 7, it seems to me there can be two approaches. One is where they allege rendering the property unbuildable for the plaintiffs. So if they allege that it is unbuildable, to me, again, that it suggests not to be able to use it. Also in paragraph 7, it is alleged making the construction of the home which they wish to construct on the property impossible in the location in which the plaintiffs wish to build it. Although they both appear in paragraph 7, if you didn't have the remaining part of paragraph 7, I'd say, they just couldn't build where they wanted to build it. But if you have the remaining part, the complaint seems to allege that it is unbuildable.
I appreciate your comments in that regard. I still don't think when you read the complaint as a whole, including that paragraph, that's the conclusion I draw is different, obviously, than the conclusion you draw. But I don't think that that's, you know, the purpose of the transaction for the Eversons is referenced in their complaint and the attached documents. They bought a vacant piece of land. They wanted to build a single-family residence on it. They couldn't build it in the location, and therefore, to them, it was unbuildable. That's just a use of that property. It's not the loss of use of the property. If there was a zoning, if you had bought a property with the idea that, geez, I want to build a single-family house, but it's zoned for commercial. They couldn't build a house. It doesn't mean that the property is unusable.
It could be used for some other
something
purpose.
Absolutely.
Like what?
This property? I've never been out there. I have no idea what you could use that property for.
Hypothetically.
It would depend on zoning. I would think, if the zoning allowed for it, perhaps they could put a small store there, maybe a large store. I'm not sure how large this property is. I'm sure there's a number of commercial-type ventures that they could probably put on there, again, presuming zoning would permit it.
Mm-hmm.
That's some hypothetical thoughts.
I understand that, and I appreciate your entertaining that. So your definition of loss of use is loss of any use, or loss of use for the intended purpose?
The former as opposed to the latter. And I think that's bared out. I mean, again, taking a look at that, Wisconsin label case, the Court of Appeals summary, admittedly the Supreme Court, you took another look at it, but looking at the Court of Appeals analysis of it, and even in Trios, I think there needs to be that total loss of use of the property. It's got to be the loss of use.
But I'm having a little logical problem here. If I owned a house and there was a serious fire in the kitchen and a tremendous amount of damage in the kitchen, it would necessarily mean that I couldn't sleep in the house or otherwise use the house in other respects. But it seems to me what you're saying when we're talking about not on physical damage but on loss of use, it's got to be nothing. No use.
In this case, I think so because you bought a piece of vacant land. In your example, you have a house. And under that analysis, when you buy a house and you're displaced from the home and that's what you purchased, admittedly it's on top of land, but you bought a house and it was intended purpose, you were kicked out for a period of time because there was fire damage that needed to be restored, I think JARS would substantiate that would be a loss of use. There they lost the use of the house for 2 months, and according to the Court of Appeals, that was sufficient to trigger that analysis. Here, the distinction is they bought a vacant piece of land. Maybe they wanted to build a single-family house on it. Maybe they wanted to do other things with it. But that's the distinction in this case. And we know it's a vacant land because they attached the offer to purchase and incorporated it by reference as part of the complaint. So that would be my position. I'm not sure how much time ultimately I'm going to have left. I'd like to move on to just a couple other points here.
Go ahead, counsel.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, do that.
Again, if there are questions. One of the things that I wanted to stress here is, again, with the duty to defend, insurance companies are not there to insure against every possible loss and every type of damage. And that's why I think these courts over the years have stressed on the importance of the language in the complaint to determine the duty to defend. And here, we need to have the allegation of property damage in here. And all we really have when you look at paragraphs on negligent misrepresentation and strict responsibility is damage. This court and the Court of Appeals in Benjamin, and this court particularly, said that's just not enough. That language of damage is just not enough. And this complaint doesn't have anything else that I think would allow for the triggering of the duty to defend. In addition, one of the other points I wanted to raise was that misrepresentations is something, a negligent misrepresentation, a strict responsibility, simply can't cause property damage. We've seen the Court of Appeals decisions on this. Even this court concluded the same in Smith versus Katz, that the misrepresentation there could not have caused the groundwater to cause the foundation problems. In Benjamin, misrepresentations didn't cause the buildings to sink or collapse. It's the condition of the property that causes it, not the misrepresentation. And we know for that really in two reasons. One, we have Wisconsin law, the cases, and if an adverse decision by this court would, I think, mandate overturning Qualman, Benjamin, and cases, and those cases have been cited around the country, and those cases would have to be overruled, I believe, in order for you not to conclude in that vein. But with strict responsibility and misrepresentation, the collectible or allowable damages are set forth right there in the jury instructions as to the type of damages that are allowed in misrepresentation cases. So we have Wisconsin law. We also have, in this case, the Eversons themselves, who have alleged specifically what caused their damage, and that was the existence of the floodplain. It is the floodplain that kept them from building the house they wanted and the location they wanted. They didn't, and that is important. As a point to raise here, the misrepresentations didn't cause this property to be unbuildable or build the home that they wanted to in the location that they wanted to. It's the floodplain. And the misrepresentations didn't cause that. One of the other points that I wanted to raise was the argument on occurrences and whether or not they can be accidents. And I briefed that in our brief here, but it's our position that misrepresentations just don't constitute, at least in the real estate context, misrepresentations don't constitute occurrences. there are volitional acts. You turn over that property condition report and essentially tell somebody, here, rely upon that. I didn't accidentally give them the real estate condition report, even though there may have been. And I guess the jury's still out on whether or not it was a typographical error or not, since we still have the complaint alleging misrepresentation intentional. But that's a volitional act. I turn that over and I hand it to someone and says, here, rely upon this. It's not an accident. The other point that I wanted to raise that we briefed here is the exclusions. And even if you should happen to disagree and find that there's an occurrence, causation, property damage, and all of that, part of the analysis in the duty to defend is to go ahead and take a look at the four corners of the complaint, the four corners of the insurance policy. We look at the grant of insurance, we look at the definitions, we also look at the exclusions. And we do have the alienated premises exclusion in the policy, which says that we're not going to provide coverage for damage to property, which is property you own, rent, occupy, and then definition two is premises you sell, give away, or abandon if the property damage arises out of any part of those premises. It's exactly what happened here. And this court, I could not find any cases in Wisconsin that address that specific issue other than a passing reference by this court in Smith v. Katz summarizing what the Court of Appeals in Smith v. Katz did. But I think the case law around the state, if the case law around the country supports that position, that the premises you sell exclusion is unambiguous here and would apply to preclude any possibility of property damage being indemnified under the policy.
Help me a little bit more on this volitional act. Suppose I negligently cause some damage to property when I'm driving a vehicle. I mean, isn't there a volitional act in starting up the car, driving it, driving over some statuary, there's got to be a volitional act. What's the difference here?
The difference here is the volitional act is filling out the property condition report and perhaps typographically making the error of 21 versus 31. That's perhaps your negligent act. But once you turn it over and say, here, rely upon it, and hand that property condition report to someone and says, here, rely upon this, that becomes volitional. That's not accident. That's not a unforeseen, unexpected, unplanned event or circumstance, which is what we've looked at. An accident has a lack of intention. And here, there isn't any doubt as to the intention here. Not only do we have the language of the apparent, and we'll just, the apparent improper reference to lots 21 and 31, but take a look at question number 5, the answer to it, and it says, we've done more than just simply have a typographical error if we accept that. We have a language, the floodplain does not affect any lot's ability to construct a residence on land outside of the floodplain. We're doing more than just a typographical error. We're trying to sell somebody some property. And we're telling them specifically, unless it's listed here, it's not in the floodplain. So we're doing more than simply having an error. We're turning it over. We're trying to sell somebody. We're trying to induce them to rely upon that representation to buy that property.
Counselor, do you agree with opposing counsel that any impact that the economic loss doctrine has on this case is something that should be raised in a motion to dismiss or in a motion for summary judgment?
Absolutely not. Okay. I wholeheartedly disagree.
You want to tell me why?
Sure. First of all, the economic loss doctrine is not a coverage defense. We know that. You've stated it in American Girl. It's not. However, the economic loss doctrine can determine whether or not ultimately the claims are covered under a policy. In Wausau Tile, that's what happened. They analyzed the case. They found that the tort claims were barred by the economic loss doctrine, leaving just the contract case. And in Wausau Tile, there was the agreement, apparently, as characterized by this court in American Girl, that contract claims weren't covered under a policy. Therefore, the carrier had no obligation under the policy. But the economic loss doctrine is not something that a carrier should be precluded from raising as part of a in conjunction with a coverage position. Because if the tort claims cannot stand as a matter of law in the face of the economic loss doctrine, then they should be excised from the case, dismissed, and proceed on those claims that can stand in the face of the economic loss doctrine.
But the plaintiff in the tort case is not here. Right? The plaintiff is not here, the Eversons. And you're asking us to say they have no claim under tort. Therefore, you're not, you, the insurance company, are not liable to the Lorenzes. So what happens when they continue their lawsuit against the Lorenzes? Do the Eversons, do we have a claim preclusion, issue preclusion, judicial estoppel? I mean, how can you bar them on a claim here? And you'll have, or you have inconsistent possibilities. And where have I gone wrong?
I'm sorry, the last.
Where have I gone wrong?
We have not asserted the economic loss doctrine as a defense in response to the question of whether or not the economic loss doctrine could serve to address coverage. Absolutely, it can. It hasn't been raised yet by the insurance company.
In this case.
In this case, it hasn't been raised, nor by
us. Do we have to reach economic loss doctrine in this case?
I don't think you can, and well, you can do anything. I don't think you will, because no one's really presented it here.
Not only has it not been presented, if it were presented, it would be very tough for this court to deal with the Everson versus Lorenz issue on economic loss, because Everson is not here.
If
you don't represent Everson.
No, I do not.
And clearly Lorenz's counsel doesn't represent Everson.
Agreed.
All right.
If we raised it as part of a summary judgment brief down at the trial court and the Evensons were there.
Yeah. No problem.
Yes.
No problem. I agree with that. Okay. But it's not in this case between you and the Lorenzes.
Not yet, anyway.
All right. Not yet. Right. That's all
I
want.
Do here.
That's the answer I wanted. Not yet.
Thank you.
Could Pekin ever be liable for contract, breach of contract damages or contract damages?
I suppose so. Looking at American Girl, I think that it is possible that if the conduct, depending upon the language of the policy, depending upon the conduct of the parties, depending upon the damages and causation issues, is it possible? Yes. For example, I think in American Girl, this court made it clear that breach of contracts aren't automatically outside the scope of coverage. Unless there are any other further questions, I have nothing else, and I thank you very much for your time.
I think you addressed this briefly, but once more, your own property, could you address that?
Oh, the premises you sell exclusion?
Yeah.
Sure. The premises you sell exclusion is, it's in the policy. It states very clearly that we're not going to provide coverage for property damage, and we're not going to provide coverage for property damage to premises you sell, give away, or abandon if the property damage arises out of any part of those premises. Now, this court, in passing reference, made it clear that that's what the Court of Appeals in Smith versus Katz decided, made its decision on, was the premises you sell exclusion. This court actually made the comment that they anticipated in oral arguments that you were going to be addressing that, and you ended up not even getting to that point because you had found that in the initial grant of coverage there wasn't in the Smith versus Katz case here. It's exactly what happened. You have premises, land that Lorenz owned that he sold, and the Eversons are claiming damage that stems from the premises which were sold. And under the clear and unambiguous language of that exclusion, it's going to bar any possibility of coverage, even if you could find coverage in the initial grant.
So do we need to even get to the other issues if we accept that premise? Doesn't that solve your problem?
It does solve my problem, although I think in running through the analysis, I think we go through the grants first and then we look to the exclusions. But, yeah, I don't think we're going to – I don't think you're going to have to get to the premises you sell exclusion to decide this case because I don't think there's coverage found in the initial grant.
But is that exclusion – how does that exclusion, if it applies, fit into the – analysis of your duty to defend?
Well, the exclusion can certainly determine whether or not I have a duty to defend. If you find occurrence, causation, damages, we still look at exclusions to determine whether the company has a duty to defend. I've cited in the brief, I believe the Brunner case was an example of that, how exclusions can absolutely determine whether or not one has a duty to defend. Intentional acts is a classic example. So I certainly think exclusions can be there. The last comment I'd like to put on here is simply that we all know that insurance coverage is determined by the language of the policy, the complaints at issue. But, frankly, it's really not surprising, and I've made this point before at the trial court and the Court of Appeals, that it's not surprising that we're not going to have coverage here under a CGL policy. These aren't really the types of policies, if we look at the policy as a whole, that are designed to respond to these types of claims. Real estate agents don't have problems with this issue because they're going to be the grant of coverage in those types of policies extends for errors, mistakes, omissions in performance of professional services. He's selling property here. That's what he's doing. And it's just not a surprise that we're not going to have coverage under this specific type of insurance vehicle.
Counsel, I haven't carefully reread American Family. I just skimmed it. But as I recall, that was a CGL policy, too.
Yes, it was.
How does that fit in with your argument that as I understand your argument, that it would be more appropriate to have an errors and omissions policy as opposed to a CGL as American Family?
Sure. Under American Girl, this Court did uphold the professional services exclusion to preclude coverage under some circumstances. In American Girl, one of the things that this Court looked at was the contract between the developer or the general and Pleasant Company saying that the developer agreed to be responsible for any and all damages that stemmed as a result of the construction of this warehouse. And that was such a broad, sweeping scope of agreement. That's where the Court went down, I think, in looking at it. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Durache, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
So what about the exclusion?
The exclusion doesn't apply.
How come?
We're not claiming that... Eversons are claiming property damage to property that Lorenz owns, rents, occupies, sold, gave away, or abandoned.
But they did sell it.
Well, they sold a lot of real estate, but remember my damage analysis is Eversons claiming damage as a result of loss of use of things that they bought themselves. The exclusion doesn't cover those sorts of damages. I'm not saying that Eversons are claiming damage.
Not claiming damage for the loss for the loss of the land or in value, et cetera, but extraneous matters that they bought in order to build.
That's right.
Okay.
Other than that, I guess we've got the intent to induce reliance. Argument that was discussed a little bit. What I'd like to point out on that is intent to induce reliance. While it may be an element, and I mentioned this in my brief, while it may be an element of negligent misrepresentation in some jurisdictions, including some that decided cases that counsel has cited, it's not an element of negligent misrepresentation in Wisconsin. On the economic loss doctrine, the only reason I'm going to point this out is because of the not yet comment. I've read the amicus brief filed by the Civil Trial Council of Wisconsin, and on page 5, seems to me they're taking a position that's contrary to that stated by Mr. Weiss here today. For example, a party can plead a claim of property damage stemming from negligence sounding in tort, yet be clearly barred in recovery by the economic loss doctrine due to the presence of a contract. The insurer would have a duty to defend such a claim so long as the tort claim was within the plain scope of the policy language, although the duty to indemnify would never arise. And that's what we're arguing here. We're arguing that the tort claim was within the scope of the policy language. I have an example on cause that I just, because the cause issue has come up, following up on some earlier questions. Let's say we have a county road that has a sharp curve in it. County puts up a sign, one of those yellow signs with the black arrow, but instead road curves to the right, they put an arrow on it that curves to the left. Plaintiff's going down the road, he goes the wrong way. I think Mr. Weiss would say that the road caused him to go off and either damage his car or sustain loss of use because it got stuck in the mud. I think the analysis is much more straightforward than that. He's going to say, if the sign would have pointed me the right way, I'd have stayed on the road and I wouldn't have been damaged. So that helps me believe, and that example contains all the elements of negligent misrepresentation in Wisconsin, and I think we've got the same situation here. The Iversons are saying, we bought the lot because of what we understood, the information we received from Lorenz, and we were damaged. We wouldn't have bought the lot if we'd have been told otherwise, and we wouldn't have been damaged. I don't think cause should be a hang-up. Finally, on this argument that there has to be a complete loss of use or there's no loss of use under the policy, I really have trouble with that one, and I gathered from some of the questions that perhaps the court does too. Seems to me that if that's really the case, then that loss of use argument's illusory. I can't imagine that the court would step in the shoes of a plaintiff, especially with something as subjective as a home. I mean, there are a few things more subjective than a home, and say, well, on a duty to defend insurance basis, we're going to say that there hasn't been a total loss of use. You know, to these plaintiffs, they're saying that there was a loss of use, and maybe that's a merits question. Maybe if this gets to the jury will say, you know, these people are nitpickers, and we're not going to give them any money. But that's not a consideration at this stage. Unless the court has any questions of me, that's all the comments I wanted to make, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gershay, and thank you, Mr. Weiss, for your arguments today in yet another insurance coverage case, and I'm sure they're very helpful to the court. And that concludes our hearing in 03-1331, Iversen et al. Versus Lorenz et al. Thank you. Keep warm.